Chapter 4 is where we'll be for just a moment. And then we will finish up chapters 5 and 6. Whether we like the way we finish them up or not, we will finish them up. Chapter 4, we saw Nebuchadnezzar's dream where he saw the tree. And that tree, of course, was him. He heard in that dream that this tree was to be cut down. It would come back later, but only after he, this individual, had experienced insanity and come to appreciate the sovereignty of God. Daniel interpreted that dream for him, and he experienced it just exactly as God had predicted. And we're ready for verse 34. At the end of the time, those seven times, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned to me. And I blessed the Most High and praised and honored Him who lives forever. Notice how he lifted his eyes to heaven. It had been a voice which fell from heaven in verse 31, just before the insanity began. As soon as the insanity ends, his eyes are toward heaven. I don't know if we're getting a picture there of maybe enough sanity was there towards the end that he could lift his eyes and claim, speak to God his humility and then his sanity returns, or if he just looks up upon his sanity returning and kind of picks up where he left off, now knowing who reigns in the affairs of men. But whatever the case be, in verse 34, I blessed the Most High and praised and honored Him who lives forever, for His dominion is an everlasting dominion. I now know mine is not. His kingdom is from generation to generation. I now know mine is not. All the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing, even me. He does according to His will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. No one can restrain His hand or say to Him, "What have you done?" At the same time, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my honor and splendor returned to me. My counselors and nobles resorted to me. I was restored to my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added to me. Will Durant has something very interesting to say. Tradition in the book of Daniel, he writes, tell us Nebuchadnezzar, after a long reign of uninterrupted victory and prosperity, fell into a strange insanity, thought himself a beast, walked on all fours, and ate grass. For 4 years, his name disappears from the history and governmental records of Babylonia. It reappears for a moment, and then in 562 BC, he passes away. That's interesting. Now, seven times passed, probably 7 years, and yet Durant is saying when we look at the historical records prior to his death, there's just 4 years that his name disappears. Now, I don't know for sure that those two coincide, but if they do, and we've got 7 years of insanity, but just 4 years of his name disappearing from the records. Of course, the skeptic might say, well, there's a great example of your Bible and the reality not lining up. Now, I'm going to speculate here, but I think there are ways we can make this fit. If the kingdom is embodied in Nebuchadnezzar, as I have suggested, if Nebuchadnezzar goes crazy and the kingdom knows about it, what are people going to do? This is going to be a problem. Major instability is going to ensue. You can just imagine, and I do imagine here, but you can imagine the people in high places who drove him out, maybe because they had no choice, trying to keep up appearances. In that kind of world, they're not expecting to see their king on TV. They're not expecting to hear him on the radio. Most people are going to go their whole lives never having seen the king. But these leaders can continue to issue decrees in his name. They continue to keep up that appearance. Oh, he's sick. We're still able to make decisions with him at his bedside, but there's this reason or that reason you haven't seen him. And then finally, after going so long, discontinuing the charade. I speculate there, but it's just one possibility. But I have always found that statement by Durant interesting. 4 years, his name disappears. Then it comes back for just a little while, and then he dies. And I do wonder if it's the same time period there. Notice verses 35 and 36, which we've already read. Here's this third, what I'm calling evangelistic declaration. And notice how it differs from the ones that have preceded it. In chapter 2, verse 47, when Nebuchadnezzar was speaking of God, he speaks of God as the God of gods. In chapter 3, verse 29, we have Nebuchadnezzar saying the following: therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or language who speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces. Their houses shall be made in an ash heap, because there is no other God who can deliver like this. Well, when we get to chapter 4, in this third phase of his experiences with the one true and living God, we don't hear anything about another God. Now, I can't prove beyond the shadow of a doubt that Nebuchadnezzar has left his polytheism behind entirely, but you do wonder that maybe he has finally come to the point where he sees there's nothing to all these idols and these temples and these false gods. Here's a God who acts in the affairs of men. And He is the one God. I was afraid maybe I had overstated the case yesterday because I don't know for sure that He's left His polytheism behind, but He has certainly taken some steps in the right direction. And as a Gentile, I don't know that He was expected to leave His polytheism behind. Remember Naaman. Naaman says to Elisha, he's just had this healing, and he says, now I'm going to go home, and my master is going to put his hand on me, and he's going to expect me to bow down in the temple of his God. And what does Elisha say? Go in peace. Go in peace. I don't think he would have said that to a Jew. But to this Gentile, he says, go in peace. So this law that was written in the heart of the Gentile taught them not to do certain things, but it apparently didn't teach them not to be polytheists. And seems like to me God may have overlooked that among... We know He overlooked it. Acts 17, Paul says, these times of ignorance God overlooked, but now commands all men everywhere to repent. So Nebuchadnezzar has gotten to the point, it looks like to me, where he probably needed to be, and maybe even beyond it. That's chapter 4. Well, let's do read that last verse. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of Heaven, all of whose works are truth and His ways justice, and those who walk in pride He is able to put down. And that's the thesis statement of the chapter. That could have been put as a topical statement right at the beginning. Here's a man who has learned that he'd better humble himself before God, or God will humble him himself. Any comments on chapter 4? Let's jump into chapter 5 then. Chapter 5 records for us events in the reign of Babylon's last king. And it actually records for us events on the last night of the reign of that last king, Belshazzar. As we begin the chapter, I know we're familiar with this, but as we begin the chapter, we're in the city of Babylon, but Cyrus and his armies are outside the city. And they've got a plan, and they're going to put it into action that night, and it's going to result in Babylon's fall. And I'll read to you what one individual said about the city of Babylon to kind of give you a sense for why Belshazzar is so unconcerned. At the same time the city was besieged and taken over by Cyrus, it actually had 20 years of supplies on the inside of it already stored. Not to mention the many acres that were there on the inside of the city walls where they farmed every year and could have replenished the supply of grain. So 20 years here, we've got all these acres where we can continue to farm, and we've got these walls that are some 300 feet high. We've talked about how that the Babylonian walls in other classes were wide enough that a chariot with four horses could run along the top of it. But Herodotus tells us that more than that, on the top of the walls were houses on either side, house here and house here, and then between those houses that chariot could run. So enormous walls. Cyrus is reputed to have said that he saw no way that someone could take those walls by assault. So they're stuck out there behind these enormous walls. We've got enough food here for 20 years and we can keep replenishing our stocks. We've got nothing to worry about. That's the attitude prevailing inside the city and in this feast when it begins. So let's begin it. Belshazzar the king made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in the presence of the 1,000. Belshazzar could be understood to be the literal son of Nebuchadnezzar if you were just reading this chapter by itself. Multiple times Nebuchadnezzar is called his father, but that's not the case. Nebuchadnezzar reigned for 43 years. 23 years later, the kingdom falls. But in that 23 years, as I mentioned earlier this week, we have five monarchs. Nebuchadnezzar's son, when Nebuchadnezzar died in 562, his son, and if you've got those sheets in your notebook, by the way, here's where we're actually going to use them. One of the times, the very first one is a list of the kings of Neo-Babylonia down at the bottom. I didn't bother to remove the kings of Syria. Those don't really have any purpose for us. But the kings of Neo-Babylonia, that's the kingdom we're dealing with. Nabopolassar, Nebuchadnezzar's father, got the kingdom started. Nebuchadnezzar took power. And then after him, his son Amel-Marduk, or Evil Merodach, as the Jews called him, took power. Evil Merodach reigned between 562 and 560 B.C. And he is mentioned in the Bible, by the way, if you're interested in that. 2 Kings 25. 2 Kings 25, verses 27 through 30, mention this son of Nebuchadnezzar, Evil Merodach, as does Jeremiah 52. Jeremiah 52, 31 through 34. Now, Amel Marduk, or Evil Merodach, is assassinated by his brother-in-law, Nergal-Sar, the next king you see there, who reigned from 560 to 556 B.C. This Nergal-Sar, or Nergal-Sharazar, may be the same man who is mentioned in Jeremiah 39. There was an official among the Babylonians who came into Jerusalem when the occupying troops from Babylon came in. It may be the man who became this Nergal-Sar that we have right here. His was a reign of peace. We have no known wars. He dies a natural death and is succeeded by his son, Labashi-Marduk, who reigns just 9 months there in 556. Labashi-Marduk is murdered, and then Nabonidus comes to power. And Nabonidus bears what relation to Belshazzar? He's his father. He is his father. Nabonidus is married, it appears, to Nebuchadnezzar's daughter, Nitocris, Nitocris. And he reigns from 556 to 539 B.C., but you don't see a Belshazzar there on this list of kings of Babylon. And that's a little misleading, although I understand why they have done that. Nabonidus was an interesting character. He held the throne for 17 years, but he preferred archaeology to government. He spent his time excavating the antiquities of Sumeria while his own realm went to ruin. He would build and restore temples, some quite ancient. He really wasn't interested in the affairs of state. So he was king, but when it came to the actual governing, he gave that to his son, Belshazzar. And Belshazzar is given that opportunity beginning in 553 B.C., and that's a date that's not on there. From 553 to about 539 B.C., Belshazzar is playing co-regent, a subordinate king, but a king nonetheless, to his father Nabonidus. His name, by the way, means Bel protected the king. You see in these names the names of their gods. You see that Nabopolassar, Nebuchadnezzar. You see Marduk there. And so anyway, their names of their gods were incorporated into their names. As to why Belshazzar is called, that Nebuchadnezzar is called his father, probably because he is his grandfather. His mother, Nitocris, which Herodotus speaks of, seems to have been Nebuchadnezzar's daughter. Furthermore, you don't even have to be a lineal descendant to be the son of, in Eastern parlance, necessarily. We have found an Assyrian document. The Assyrian records say that Jehu, for example, was the son of Omri. Now, who's Omri?
Father of Ahab.
Father of Ahab. Omri was king in Israel, father of Ahab. And what did Jehu do to Ahab? Killed him. And killed his sons, and had Jezebel killed and so forth. There's no lineal relation there at all that we know of. And yet, here are the Assyrians calling Jehu son of Omri. Now, sure, they could have been misinformed, or it may just be when you take the throne that your predecessor had, you are the son of. So either way, there's a way of explaining this father-son relationship. Just one more thing about Belshazzar. I mean, we know him for this impious feast that he holds here. One source says, this is Olmsted from his History of the Persian Empire. He writes that, highly centralized in the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Babylonia had progressively disintegrated under the weakling rule of Belshazzar. Misrule and graft were rampant, the peasants were oppressed, their fields went out of cultivation. By 546, once fertile Babylonia faced the threat of starvation. This man was interested in himself, interested in his own pleasures and the pleasures of those close to him perhaps, but he had no interest in benefiting the kingdom, and he hurt the kingdom in the worst way here at this in this chapter. So let's pick up now in verse 2. While he tasted the wine, Belshazzar gave the command to bring the gold and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple, which had been in Jerusalem, that the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. He does the unthinkable here. Here are these sacred vessels that belong to the house of God. They never should have been in Babylon to begin with. This is the God who humbled his grandfather. And for some reason, on this night, when we're feasting and rioting and partying and dancing, we're going to bring those in. We're going to go to the trouble. Go get them. Bring them in here. We're going to go to the trouble to fill them with wine. We're going to drink out of them. And then while we do so, verse 3, they brought the gold vessels that had been taken from the temple of the house of God, which had been in Jerusalem. And the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron, wood and stone. It's obvious, I think, that this was intended as a slap in the face to Jehovah. Now, why he chose Jehovah over any of over a number of false gods that could have been chosen, I do not know. Unless it's because the name of Jehovah in the life of Nebuchadnezzar and others has begun to get to enough of a foothold in Babylon that here he is, he's going to exert his force here and make a point. I speculate. I don't know. but it is an intended mockery, it seems to me. Dishonoring God by using these sacred vessels for a time such as this and in a way such as this, and then adding insult to injury by praising false gods. Well, God has His limits, and tonight, God's had enough of this. In the same hour, verse 5, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, and the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Are these walls plaster? Or are they pre-plaster? I know nothing about architecture. Do you know, Tom?
Well, they're plastered over solid brick.
Okay. So maybe, in a loose sense, we can kind of get an idea. Imagine walls here, very ornately decorated, maybe multicolored with Eastern imagery on them. I don't know exactly what it was. Opposite the lampstand. I don't know if this could be the lampstand from the temple that they have brought in which case that's really something. But a lampstand, maybe there's some light being cast on that part of the wall, and here we are rioting and reveling, and then fingers appear. And everyone sees them. And letters begin to be inscribed in the wall. Do they hear the sound of the letters being inscribed? I don't know. But letters begin to appear on the wall. Now, let's say we're here tonight when the lights are gone. We've got some lamplight going on. That's the best we've got. And that happens. What would be your response? I think our response would be very similar to Belshazzar's. Belshazzar's response in verse 6. Then the king's countenance changed, I'd say. And his thoughts troubled him so that the joints of his hips were loosened and his knees knocked against each other. Now we laugh at that. It is very descriptive. But here's the man who is scared to death. This is terror. What's going on here? This is unnatural. This is unearthly. This is supernatural. The king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. The king spoke, saying to the wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and tells me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck, and he shall be third ruler in the kingdom." Now, why third ruler? Because that's the best he's got. Now, all the kingdom's wise men came, but we're not surprised to learn they could not read the writing or make known to the king its interpretation. And again, it's interesting. What do we have here? They look at that and they say, now, these are words that are familiar to them, it seems, as we're going to find later in the chapter. These are words that by themselves they would know what they mean, but there's nothing to connect the thoughts. So they see words that they may recognize, but I don't know what those words, I don't know why they're together, I don't know what idea I'm supposed to get from them. And these magicians and astrologers and so forth, they don't either. They maybe don't even offer anything. We don't know, king. Then King Belshazzar was what? My translation says more than troubled. Does the King James just say troubled? Greatly troubled. He was troubled back in what, verse 6? Now he's greatly troubled. His countenance was changed, and his lords were astonished. Verse 10. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came to the banquet hall. Now let's just stop right there. We learned back in verse 2 that who was in this banquet hall with them? His wives and his concubines. So who's this? Yeah, I think this is maybe the queen mother. Maybe this is, maybe it could even be a step-grandmother, maybe one of Nebuchadnezzar's younger wives, or it is Nitocris, Nabonidus' wife. Queen mother comes in, and she's got some age on her. She's got the position of having been of possibly a previous administration or the current administration, and people listen. The queen comes to the banquet hall, and the queen spoke, saying, "O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts trouble you, nor let your countenance change. There is a man in your kingdom, in whom is the Spirit of the Holy God. And in the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. And inasmuch as an excellent spirit, knowledge, understanding, interpreting dreams, solving riddles, and explaining enigmas were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar, now let Daniel be called, and he will give the interpretation." There is a man. She remembers. Some time has passed since Nebuchadnezzar's administration. There have been changes in administration. There's probably been changes of cabinet. Daniel may have been given another job in another place a long time ago. And Belshazzar may have absolutely no relationship, no knowledge of this man, but here's a woman who remembers, who's been around long enough to know what happened in time past. She doesn't even call him Belteshazzar. She says, Nebuchadnezzar named him Belteshazzar. She calls him Daniel. Almost as if there's some relationship here. The family. Daniel can help us with this. And notice how also she describes him in verse 11. There is a man in your kingdom in whom what? Is the Spirit of the Holy God. That is the exact way that Nebuchadnezzar spoke of Daniel in the fourth chapter. Three times Nebuchadnezzar referred to him this way. Verses 8, 9, and 18. In whom is the Spirit of the Holy God? This is a woman going back a generation possibly, referring to him in the exact same way. This man can help us. He can explain enigmas. He can untie knots. If we've got a Gordian knot here, he can come in and clear it up for us. So enter Daniel. Then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king spoke and said to Daniel, "Are you that Daniel who is one of the captives from Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah? I have heard of you that the Spirit of God is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now, the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me that they should read this writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they could not give the interpretation of the thing. And I have heard of you that you can give interpretations and explain enigmas. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Oh, Daniel's impressed with that. Ruler for 15 minutes. Daniel answered and said before the king, "Let your gifts be for yourself. I don't need what you're offering. Give your rewards to another. Give them to someone else. Yet I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation." And here it comes. And it begins with a history lesson. This is good. Daniel has got some years under his belt. He's seen a lot of life. Maybe here in his early 80s. But Belshazzar is just a young buck. Let me begin by giving you a history lesson. And by the way, remember Stephen, Acts chapter 7. Isn't that exactly what he did? He's going to make a point with the Jews by taking them through history. This is what the Jews have always done. They have always rejected God's prophets. They did it, he did it, they did it, they did it, and you're just like them. And it made the point powerfully. They were convicted by it, if they were willing to be. So Daniel begins with a history lesson, a lesson from an eyewitness. Verse 18, "O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father a kingdom and majesty, glory and honor. And because of the majesty that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whomever he wished, he executed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. And whomever he wished, he put down. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. Then he was driven from the sons of men. His heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men and appoints over it whomever he chooses. But you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all this." You know, Belshazzar could end Daniel's life right here. And Daniel knows that. But I wonder if these are the words of an old soldier. He's been around for decades and decades. He's come awfully far. He knows he doesn't have too far to go. Any fear of man he might have had, and from what we see when he was young, he didn't have a whole lot, but any fear of man he might have had time to dissipate. And some things are more important than personal safety anyway. And speaking the truth is one of them. "You knew all this, Belshazzar, and you disregarded it. Instead, verse 23, you have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. They have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your lords, your wives, and your concubines have drunk wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, bronze and iron, wood and stone, which do not see or hear or know. And the God who holds your breath in his hand and owns all your ways, you have not glorified. Then the fingers of the hand were sent from him, and this writing was written." Daniel is a book of timing. In the ninth chapter, Daniel has been looking at the book of Jeremiah. He comes to see that there's just going to be 70 years of captivity, and he begins praying to God. And later in the chapter, this magnificent prophecy of the 70 weeks is brought to him by Gabriel. And Gabriel tells him, "When you started to pray, that's when I was sent. When you did this, God did this." Well, that's what Daniel's saying here. Belshazzar, when you did this, God sent the hand, sent those fingers. Verse 25. And this is the inscription that was written. Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. This is the interpretation of each word. Mene. God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. The word Mene means numbered. God has put a limit on your kingdom. Teach us to number our days. God has numbered your kingdom and time is up. Tekel. You have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Tekel means to weigh. You've been weighed in the balances and found wanting or found what?
Lacking.
Lacking. Belshazzar, you don't weigh enough. You're a spiritual lightweight. Your heart is filled with things that are inconsequential and an affront to God. They don't weigh a thing. And the weighty matters of the law you have disregarded. Perez. Now, why does it say Perez? Perez is the exact same word as Upharsin. Perez is the singular form. Upharsin is the plural form. That seems strange to us as English speakers because when we pluralize something, we just throw an S on the end of it. But other languages are not that way. I don't know much about Hebrew. I know a little bit about Greek. And in Greek, it's an inflected language. And a word's form can change considerably depending upon what part it's playing in a sentence. But Upharsin is the same word. It's just the pluralized form. And it's probably plural. I'm guessing it's pluralized because it's referring to the Medes and the Persians. But Perez, which means to divide, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Like a pie, it's been cut up and it's going to be given to someone else. There is something interesting here that I'd like to put up on the board. Interesting to me, and those of you who like language will find this interesting. This word for Perez is for Strong's users is 6537. And it's written out in English characters like this. And it's pronounced like this. Now the word for Persians, which this Perez is connected to, is just 6540 in the in Strong's. In English characters, it looks like this. And it's pronounced like this. So, your kingdom has been divided, Peras, to the Persians, Poras. And you know, in the original language, there seems to have been quite a bit of that in the Bible. I come across those things once in a while. I'll give some examples. And some of you may find this interesting. For example, like in Zechariah 9, verse 3, the English says, Tyre has built herself a tower. Now, there's a little bit of alliteration there, Tyre, tower. In the Hebrew, it's something more like this. Sor, that's Tyre, Sor has built herself a matzor. There's just kind of a way of, we hear public speakers do this sort of thing all the time. Take two words that kind of sound alike to kind of make it ring. In Nahum chapter 2, Nineveh is going to be empty, desolate, waste. In the Hebrew, it's something like this. Buka, ume buka, ume bulaka. These memorable ways of saying things. And there are other examples. But I just wonder if there's an intended connection here. It's going to go to the Persians and the Medes. The Persians are the dominant people. Peres, peras, you've been divided and you're going to paras, the Persians. Verse 29. I'm going to close my bookmark. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a chain of gold around his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. Whether you want it or not, you got it. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain. There are lots of predictions in the prophets about the fall of Babylon. One of those is in Jeremiah 50. Jeremiah 50, verses 35 and 38. I'm taking these verses piecemeal because I'm just wanting to notice certain things about them. But Jeremiah 50, verses 35 and 38, this prediction had been made. A sword is against the Chaldeans, says the Lord, against the inhabitants of Babylon. A drought is against her waters, and they will be dried up. Jeremiah 51, 36. Therefore, thus says the Lord, I will dry up her sea and make her springs dry. Now, why is that in there? Well, I know many of us know. This night, while Belshazzar is partying and rioting, Cyrus, who is a very determined man, has been hard at work, and he's got a plan he's putting into place, perhaps while during the very moments that we're reading about. And I'll read to you what Herodotus had to say about it. Herodotus lived in the 400s B.C. This event took place in about 539 B.C. Herodotus was closer to these events than we are to the Civil War, and perhaps even closer or about as we are to World War I. Very close in time, at least. And he's writing from a secular standpoint about the things that happened this night. Here's what he says. The Babylonians, they had stored up provisions ahead of time, enough for many years. So now they made no account of the siege. And Cyrus was at his wit's end as the time grew longer and longer, and his business was no way advanced. Here's a man who's trying to get things done. I'm not making any headway here. What are we going to do? He stationed his main army on the river where it enters the town. Now, the city of Babylon straddled the Euphrates River. I know many of us know this. And the Euphrates River ran right through the city, and of course it ran under the walls. But it wasn't easy to get under those walls with the river as it was. And then even when it came into the city, they had walls on either side. I mean, they weren't stupid. They knew there was the potential, I suppose, of someone getting in there. So they even had walls and gates on either side, so if someone did get in, they still wouldn't be able to get in. Well, he stationed his main army on the river where it enters the town, and some other troops behind the town where the river issues forth. So he's got it where it goes in and where it goes out. And he bade his men, when they saw the stream becoming fordable, so when it got low enough that you could actually walk in it, to enter the city by the riverbed. Having made his dispositions thus, and having given his instruction in this sense, he drew off himself with the least useful part of his army. Now, Nitocris, if I remember this correctly, had done a number of things, either in defense of the city or in producing to help irrigation. If I remember this right, and I think this is correct, she had caused the river to zigzag as before it got to Babylon. That slowed down the current of the river. And then she had a huge lake dug over to on one side of the river. Cyrus takes advantage of this by use of a canal. He directed the river by a canal into the lake, which had become a marsh. And so when the river had sunk, all the water starts pouring into that enormous lake. Of course, the river level goes down, and suddenly we can get in under the wall and we can walk in the stream. The old stream became fordable. When this happened, the Persians, who for this very purpose were stationed along the stream, entered Babylon by the riverbed when the Euphrates had sunk till it reached but to the middle of a man's thigh. So here it is in the middle of the night, big party going on, and Cyrus's men are walking right under those walls, right through the water and coming into the city. And of course, the gates have not been secured sufficiently, and so even though they've been able to get in, they might not have been able to get in, but through negligence, they just walk right into the city. They had a festival going on at that time, and they continued dancing and enjoying themselves until they learned the truth all too well. The city was big enough that some parts had been taken when other parts didn't even know it yet. But they found out well enough, and I believe one individual cites that Belshazzar died with his saber in his hand. He was ready to fight, but it didn't last long. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain. And Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. This Darius the Mede may be synonymous with a man by the name of Gobryas, who was actually made governor of this region, and not necessarily... I think there may have been people in time past who thought that this Darius was actually over Cyrus, but I think what we have here, based on the sources I've consulted, is Cyrus is the ultimate king, but he has given this Darius the Mede power over this region. Not instead of or over Cyrus, but under Cyrus, just over this area. That's all I have on chapter 5. Anyone have anything you want to offer or ask? Yes, Sam.
I just noticed this. I'm not sure if it has any significance, so we'll see about it. In chapter 5, verse 4, when it's listing the gods of the praising, it lists gold, silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone in that order. But when you get to verse 23, it lists silver before gold. And if we go back to Nebuchadnezzar's dream, it would be silver that would represent the Persian Empire. That's the silver before the gold at that point.
I don't know. I don't know either. The silver's about ready to take over.
Yeah, that's
interesting. That is interesting. I don't have anything to offer on it, though. Anything else? Yes, Mike.
Maybe another issue of why he chose to bring the vessels from the temple of God. These might have been superior in the way they were made. This might have been deed that he had?
Possibly. I'll impress them with bringing out my, yeah.
Bring out silver, or in this case, the gold, and everything.
Yes, Tom?
This is not really important in our teaching, but a number of books that have markings have Darius as Darius, instead of Darius, the accent on the second syllable and the long I, Darius.
Yeah. I have a Persian friend who years ago when we were in college, we were talking about this. He's Persian. He's from Iran. He speaks Farsi. And he told me that the correct pronunciation of the name is Dariush. So we're all wrong. And I imagine with almost all of these names that is the case. It's not
like they do anyway.
He thought I did a pretty good job that day. So, anyway. Yeah. I think, was it Ahasuerus? It was something like Hashayar. So
yeah.
It's hopeless. Let's go to chapter 6. It pleased Darius, this Darius the Mede who we just read about, to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be over the whole kingdom. And over these, three governors, of whom Daniel was one, that the satraps might give account to them so that the king would suffer no loss. So here are these individuals over the realm. And we've got three of them who's over the 120. And Daniel's one of them. Daniel is one of them. As soon as authority is delegated, you run the risk of corruption, and the king knew this. So let's put Daniel over him among the three, and maybe I can be sure to avoid some revenue stealing. I mean, let's make sure the revenue gets to where it belongs. Let's make sure it gets to me as well as to the other places and things happen. If there are any administrative problems, Daniel as well as these other two can help it. And Daniel is so effective at this. In verse 3, he distinguished himself above the governors and satraps. This is old news, of course. This is typical. Because an excellent spirit was found in him, the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. An excellent spirit was found in him. That was what the Queen Mother said in chapter 5, verse 12. An excellent spirit has been found in him. Now, what's an excellent spirit?
Above reproach.
Above reproach? I thought of what Jesus told James and John, remember? Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem. He sends messengers before him, Luke 9, and they come to the Samaritans, and the Samaritans say, no. See, Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem, we don't want to see him. And James and John hear this, and what is it they want to do? Shall we send fire down from heaven? Now, admittedly, they apparently have enough faith to believe that can be done. This is good. And they certainly are asking Jesus, showing an acknowledgement of his authority. But what's Jesus say? Luke 9:55 says, he turned and rebuked them and said, you do not know what manner of spirit you are of. I came to save, not to destroy. You've missed the whole boat. Your attitude is all wrong, and therefore your approach is wrong. Maybe this has something to do with what we're reading here. Daniel seems to have understood what was appropriate, when it was appropriate, why it was appropriate. His attitude about things was right, and therefore his approach was right. His actions spoke for themselves. He didn't have to go telling people, well, you know, I'm a good guy or whatever. It was evident in the way he approached things, and it probably made him a joy to work with if you had a good attitude about things at all. He was the kind of guy you wanted around. The king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm, and the others loved this idea. So the governors and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom. His equals and his inferiors start trying to find some dirt. Typical politics. This is the nature of politics. Not that you shouldn't vote or pay attention to it, but this is the nature of the beast. And we all ought to know that. I know a man who's an elder in the church who expressed to me privately one time that he'd always wanted to run for political office. And there was a reason he hadn't done so. And I don't know that reason would have ever kept him from being successful, but I imagine his morals would have kept him from being very successful. There's just limits. I have dealt with local politics. I've never held office, but just local politics in my little town of Grain Valley. And you can walk away very disenfranchised by the kind of stuff that goes on, even in local politics. So we don't want this guy in charge. Why don't they want him in charge? I don't know for sure. Maybe because when Daniel's in charge, we have to run things honestly. We can't pocket money. We can't be lazy. I know a man about my age who's been down this very road. Very competent, very good man. His reputation has moved in his industry even into another state. He's so good at what he does. But where he was at before where he is now, he had people who hated him. Hated him. And he thinks it was because, for example, he and his manager, when they came in, they started saying no more playtime. The previous manager, guys would come into work and they'd say, hey, just meet me at the lake and maybe spend the whole day or much of it at the lake. Not even do your work. Get the paycheck, but don't do a thing. No, we're going to run this thing efficiently, but people hate that. Maybe that was how it was with Daniel. When Daniel's around, we don't get what we want. So let's get him out. Let's not have him in more authority. Let's find some dirt on him. But they could find no charge or fault. Now, knowing how people dig through people's backgrounds when it comes to political things, how would you like your background dug into this to this extent? Here's a man who's been in public office for, 60 years plus? Now, I don't know if they're going back and looking at the Babylonian records, but I would think if I were one of them, I would do so. If I could get a hold of him, let's find out if he blew it over there. And all these years, and they don't find a thing, not a thing, in this man's public life, he is spotless. Furthermore, the verse says, because he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault found in him. Now that last statement, I'm not quite sure, but I wonder if this refers to his private life. We parsed through his public life. We went through all the records trying to find something. We didn't find anything. So we went to his private life. We start asking people. We start maybe spying on him. I don't know what it is. And we don't find anything there. Public or private, Daniel's record was spotless. How would you fare? I did not appreciate the kind of man that Daniel was before I really started looking at this book as I have in preparation for this. This is quite a man. No wonder God said what He did about him in Ezekiel. There was no error or fault in him. So if we're going to get him, we're going to have to manufacture something. Verse 5. These men said, "We shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God." We're going to have to do something with religion. So these governors and satraps thronged before the king. Oh, king. And said thus to him, "King Darius, live forever. All the governors of the kingdom." Lie number one. 33% of the governors have had nothing to do with what they're about to say. "All the governors of the kingdom, the administrators and satraps, the counselors and advisors have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days, except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions." Now you just wonder, how does a statement like this even get any footing? I mean, if someone comes to our president, regardless of who that president would be, this would not fly. No one would buy it. Americans would laugh at it. But you have a culture and a kingdom here that sort of thing can be gotten away with. The king is perhaps viewed as the representative, at least, if not the embodiment of Ahura Mazda, this good god for the Zoroastrians. He's infallible. That may be why it was the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. And, I am Ahura Mazda, aren't I? Okay, let's do it. Pride makes us really stupid, and this is a good example. And king, if they don't do it, if they don't petition you, during that 30 days, we're going to cast them into the den of lions. Now, we're not going to throw them into the fiery furnace, because we are Persians. Persia is the home of Zoroastrianism, and to Zoroastrians, fire is sacred. Fire is pure. Fire is good. And if we throw them into the fire, they'll become a god. That's not what we're looking for. So, let's throw them in the den of lions. Caves have been used in time past for dens, perhaps like this one, by the emperor of Morocco. Barnes cites this source, and I'd like to read it to you. It's kind of antiquated in the way it is described, but they're describing something perhaps very much like what we're reading about here. It was in Morocco. It was a large cavern in the earth. It was a cave for lions and this cavern in the earth. And in this cavern, there was a division wall. So there's this wall kind of somewhere in the middle of this cavern. You were able to look down on it, it sounds like. And in the middle of this wall is a door. And the Jews who were watching over the lions, which is somewhat ironic, they were able to open and shut the door from the top of that wall, apparently, from the top. And so you'd have the lions over on this side, and if you wanted them on this side, you could throw some food over here and open the door, and there they'd go, and then you could clean out this side of the den and so forth. This is kind of how things were arranged. This may have been the kind of arrangement that the Persians had, and apparently it was open to the sky, at least some of it. So we keep reading about getting cast down, being thrown down before they hit the bottom. So kind of get this picture that here's this cavernous area and men would be thrown down from the top and then maybe you could lay that stone over so no one could get out and save themselves and certainly so the animals couldn't get out. Verse 8. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. Therefore, King Darius signed the written decree. Now, when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home. And in his upper room with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees three times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. Daniel went home. And he doesn't go home to panic. He goes home to pray. He prays with his windows opened. He prays toward Jerusalem. Solomon had said in 1 Kings 8:30, the day the temple was set apart, may you hear it, saying to God, he said, may you hear the supplication of your servant and of your people Israel when they pray toward this place. This was something apparently they did. Not that they had to do, but that they would do. And he did it three times that day. And this was his custom. He doesn't hear this bad news and think to himself, oh, I better put some extra prayer in the basket today. He does just what he has done every other day. Three times a day. Psalm 55:17, evening and morning and at noon, I will pray and cry aloud and he shall hear my voice. I wonder if the healthiest prayer life is to some extent the regimented prayer life, where part of my day has been set aside and I just know. Part of my day gets set aside for this TV show. Well, part of my day gets set aside for prayer to God. And this is just how it is. Day after day, routine. It's part of the rhythm of life. That was the way it was for Daniel. It had been that way for years, decades. And when he prayed, it says here, he prayed and gave thanks. Thanks? For what? In everything give thanks. For this is the will of God in Christ Jesus for you. He kneels. He humbles himself before his God. They went before the king, pardon me, verse 11. Then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before he got before his God. Now, where is he making the supplication? He's at home. This is quite a picture. These men gather and it looks like they assemble at his house. I don't know if they barge through the door, if they're able to peek in through the window, or just what. It may be that it was a very, very easy thing, and I'm guessing it probably was. I mean, maybe when lunch hour rolls along, Daniel disappeared and everybody knew why. Well, Daniel's always leaving. Daniel, why do you take off at 12 o'clock every day? Where are you going? Why don't you stay here and eat with us? Well, come on, tell us what you do. Well, it's my time for prayer. Oh, okay. So just everybody knows he does this. Like the Lord, he's got this custom. It's just part of his life. He doesn't go talking about it, but people know about it. And so all you got to do is, all right, it's time. Let's go over to Daniel's. We beat down the door and there he is. Very easy to get him, perhaps. They catch him right in the act. We've got multiple witnesses now. Everyone's seen it. And they went before the king and spoke concerning the king's decree. Have you not signed a decree that every man who petitions any god or man within 30 days except you, O king, will be cast into the den of lions? Just salivating. The king answered and said, the thing is true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. He's liking the law right now. So they answered and said before the king, that Daniel, there are certain Jews. That Daniel, who is one of the captives from Judah, does not show regard for you, O king. It's exactly what the Chaldeans said about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Or for the decree that you have signed, but makes his petition three times a day. And the king, when he heard these words, was what? What a fool I have been. Boy, was I the sucker. And now because of my stupid pride, a man is going to die. A man who I appreciate, a man who I value, because I was thinking of stupid me. Displeased with himself, and I would imagine pretty quickly displeased with these men, because he sees what's going on here. Now he spends the whole day, it says here in verse 14, all day till the going down of the sun. It looks like this would happen. It had to happen at least by the going down of the sun when that happened. But he labors all day, trying to see if he can pull any strings, see if he can cajole people. Maybe he thought to himself, if I get enough people on board with this, we'll just stage a coup against the law and it doesn't matter. We're going to save this man. And what do you think he ran into as he went and tried to twist people's arms and get them to go along with him? Well, yes, and this man Daniel's going to die because they want him to die. I doubt he was getting too much help. Oh, I see. This is what everyone wanted all along. I would imagine by the end of the day, if not as soon as he saw what was happening, that he realized that everyone's in on this, or at least these guys are anyway, and there's not going to be any changing it. Well, verse 15, these men approached the king and said to the king, he's been fighting all day to stop this. Know, O king, that it is the law of the Medes and the Persians that no decree or statute which the king establishes may be changed. We're not changing this now. You know how it works. So the king gave the command, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. But the king spoke, saying to Daniel, your God whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. Now, no, these may have been more words of hope than they were of faith. They may have rung a little hollow with Daniel at the time. But to some extent, Daniel is the tale of two kings. We've seen Nebuchadnezzar learn some things, and Darius is going to learn some things this day. This God whom you serve, and that expression, whom you serve continually, he's going to use that expression at the beginning and at the end. So Daniel is put into the den. And then in verse 17, a stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signets of his lords, that the purpose concerning Daniel might not be changed. Now, I don't know exactly how this was done, and I haven't found any source that tells me exactly how this was done. It may be that you had the stone in place, and then maybe some cords were stretched across that stone to hold it in place, and on those cords, perhaps, maybe were they brought together, you could have clay or wax, and the king could impress his signet ring, and the other lords do so as well, or the wax could have been on either side, so that if that stone was moved, it would break that seal and everyone would know that the king's will had been disregarded. When I was in high school, we went to Sedalia, Missouri for a soccer tournament. And here's all these guys, and we were put in hotel rooms. And the coach told us, now when the door shuts, I'm putting a piece of tape right on the outside of the door so that if any of us went out after hours, he'd know because the tape would be broken. I've actually used that trick before. Not with my children, but in another circumstance that it's a very good tool. Well, anyway, that was maybe what was going on here. And this sounds like something else in the Scripture, doesn't it? The tomb of the Lord Jesus. I do think there may be a shadow here. Maybe not as strong a shadow as we have other places in the Bible, but a shadow nonetheless. Look at the similarities. Daniel is blameless and upright. He's been condemned through a perversion of the justice system, and they ramrodded Jesus through those trials, 6 trials, all against what the way things should have been. He's been put possibly into a cave-like situation, covered with a stone. The stone's been sealed, Matthew 27:66. They went and made the tomb secure, sealing the stone and setting the guard. And then when does Darius come to that tomb, quote-unquote, in verse 19? Very early in the morning, word for word, what Mark chapter 16, verse 2 says of the women who came to the tomb early in that morning. And of course, he comes forth from the tomb. His claims of innocence are vindicated and he triumphs over his enemies in it. There's definitely similarity there, if not intended similarity. Well, verse 18 now. The king went to his palace and spent the night fasting. He's not hungry. Maybe he's praying as well. And no musicians were brought before him. Some translations just say diversion. Some say entertainment. Gesenius thinks the word means concubines. And his sleep went from him. Then the king arose very early in the morning and went in haste to the den of lions. As soon as he can, he goes. And when he came to the den, he cried out with a lamenting voice. He's been in agony all night. He's still in agony. He doesn't know if he's going to get an answer to his request. He cried out with a lamenting voice to Daniel. The king spoke, saying to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, which he said when Daniel went in, been able to deliver you from the lions? Now, he said before that he would deliver you. So it makes me think those words were a little bit of hope. But has it happened? Verse 21, Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. Would those have been your first words? Get me out of here! Daniel's first words are words of respect. He's not uptight about this. He's been delivered by the God who has delivered him so many times before. O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lion's mouth so that they have not hurt me, because I was found innocent before him. And also, O king, I have done no wrong before you. You know, these are not arrogant words when he says, I was innocent. The Bible teaches us that we can know ourselves. Do you not know yourself that Jesus Christ is in you? Unless indeed you are disqualified. We have the ability to know where we stand with God. God gives us criteria by which to do this. And Daniel is able to look at his own life and in all humility say, I am innocent before God. And I'm innocent before you, King. I haven't done anything to merit this. Verse 23, the king was exceedingly glad for him and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. There's that idea again, up out. So Daniel was taken up out of the den and no injury whatever was found on him. Just like no smell of smoke, no singed hair. When God decides to deliver, you are untouchable. Not a thing has been harmed. And why? Because he believed in his God. Hebrews 11:33 speaks of those who through faith stopped the mouths of lions. And here's one such instance. And the king gave the command, and they brought those men who had accused Daniel. Some might say, well, the reason Daniel didn't get eaten is because the lions weren't hungry. Oh, yes, they were. And they cast them into the den of lions, them, their children, and their wives. And the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces before they ever came to the bottom of the den. This was not uncommon among those in the East. Ammianus Marcellinus, a 4th century Roman historian, writes concerning the laws of the Persians. The laws among the Persians are formidable, among which those which are enacted against the ungrateful and deserters and similar abominable crimes surpass others in cruelty, by which on account of the guilt of one, all the kindred perish. Now this is 4th century, so this was something that was known to take place, and it was in harmony with their sense of justice, as perverted as it may have been. Verse 25. I guess I don't know quite how to view that. I know that, I guess what makes me hedge on that is what happened to Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. So maybe some of you can share with me your thoughts on that if you have them. Then King Darius wrote, to all peoples, nations, and languages, and here's our 4th, if you will, evangelistic declaration, all in this Aramaic tongue. To all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell on all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and steadfast forever. His kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall endure to the end. He delivers and rescues, and he works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So, this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian, a reign which may have been concurrent, as we already discussed. We've got about 2 minutes. Does anyone have anything you'd like to ask or offer?
No.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. I believe it. Yes, Mike.
We were at a lion enclosure one time at a zoo, and there was a lion keeper there talking about the animals, and she said she was very careful never to stick her fingers through the grid if the lion came up to be petted.
Yes.
She let the lion come right next to the grid and then petted from outside the grid. Because she said she had watched them feed and they would throw in an entire cow's leg and the femur of the lion could crush the bone of that femur in consuming the meat that it was fed. And of course the femur would eat. So the crushing all their bone, it can be done.
Yeah.
That's the way they eat.
Incredible strength. Well, as you know who were here earlier in the week, I had said we would try to get to chapter 7. I hadn't necessarily intended to start chapter 7 today, but I had planned to somewhat at least to maybe get into it. We almost made it. We will begin there Monday morning, God willing. I appreciate your attention.